Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Last week, the U.S. Surgeon General declared loneliness a public health epidemic, as deadly as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day, raising the risk of premature death by 30%, with higher rates of heart disease, stroke, anxiety, depression, dementia, and suicide. Here's my 2021 conversation with Nerina Hertz about her book, The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. You can learn more at Noreena.com, Noreena.com. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Nerina Hertz, economist, journalist, author most recently of The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. And you can learn more at Noreena.com. That's Noreena.com. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. TerrenceMcNally. TerrenceMcNally.net. In 2001, I got a recommendation from Arianna Huffington that I consider interviewing a young author from the UK about her first book, The Silent Takeover, Global Capitalism and the Death of Democracy. In it, today's guest, Nerina Hertz, warned that unregulated markets, corporate greed, and overpowerful financial institutions would produce challenging global consequences that would impact most heavily on ordinary citizens. Remember, that was 2001. Fast forward, the 2008 crash, the inadequate response and lack of accountability, paving the way for Trump and Trumpism. Well, I was in line the other day and reading Hertz's new book, The Lonely Century. I read in line a lot, and seldom does it evoke such interest. Everyone I connected with asked me about it. At one point, the gentleman in front of me, within a couple of minutes, shared some very private stuff about the painful effects of loneliness in his life. When I heard about this book about a year into the pandemic, one of my first thoughts was, great timing, Nerina. Then I realized that she had to have chosen loneliness long before COVID emerged to lock us down. I have for years offered workshops and trainings to organizations on communication, and most specifically the role of narrative, and I make very clear that I believe the most important slide in my deck is the one that says simply, human beings want more than anything to feel seen and heard. Finally, one of the things I appreciate about Hertz's approach is that she broadly defines loneliness as a lack of connection, which opens us up to consider all the ways and all the spheres in our lives where we are lacking or losing connection. In his 2007 book, Deep Economy, Bill McKibben points out that in an annual poll, Americans' happiness peaked in 1958, and yet we've apparently made enormous advances since then. He believes the technological and other gains have been more than offset by the loss of community. And I believe we lost it one technological innovation, one demographic trend, one geographic shift at a time. Perhaps we didn't notice the gradual loss, but the price we've paid for convenience and mobility is high, and we need a rebirth of community, and that presents a huge challenge in a society where our pain, fear, and disappointment fuel tribalism instead. Economist, author, and journalist Nerina Hertz earned a PhD from Cambridge University and an MBA from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. She's an honorary professor at the Institute for Global Prosperity, University College London, and hosted Megahertz, London Calling, on Sirius XM. Her books include The Silent Takeover, The Debt Threat, Eyes Wide Open, and her latest, the one we'll be talking about today, The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. Welcome, Nerina Hertz, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Terrence, it's great to be reconnected with you.
Yes, as I pointed out in the intro, 2001, 20 years ago, two decades. Crazy. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Thursday, February 25th. So, first of all, How are you? How are you coping with the pandemic?
Look, it's hard. You know, we are being tested as we've never been tested before. And in California, as in the UK, it's tough. In London, where I am, since December, we've been in a really strict lockdown where we can't even go in the street and meet up with a person in the street. And we really are housebound and under strict rules around kind of even leaving our house. So it's tough, but I'm coping.
Let me just ask you, I hadn't realized it was that strict. So that's, I know, I think France or Paris has a curfew and this. You're saying that this is 24 hours a day, those sorts of limits in London?
Yes, so you're not allowed anyone to come over to your house. You're not allowed anyone to come over and meet with you in your garden even. You're not even allowed to go and sit on a park bench and speak to someone. You're not allowed to do any socializing with anyone outside your own household. You are allowed to exercise once a day and outside. Restaurants are closed, cafes are closed, all non-essential shops are closed. And it's been like that since December.
Wow. And that's because of the variant that emerged and a resurgence?
Yes, yeah. Exactly, because of the British variant.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that bad. Or that you know, that good, whichever that turns out to be. So I think you know that I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And it's nearly 20 years, or yeah, nearly by date, nearly 20 years since our first conversation, 6 years since our last. And you move between very different worlds, academia, journalism, even popular culture. How, when you look at it, how do you feel you've been able to carve this varied sort of multiple channel career?
I've been really fortunate in that I've had really amazing mentors and supporters within academia. So academia can be quite a strict environment that in some cases doesn't let you flourish in these other realms as well. But I had really great people leading the organizations I was at. I was at Cambridge University for many years, and the director of the institute I was at there is a very inspiring woman. She really championed what I was doing and understood that for me, it was really important to get my ideas and my thinking out there so that people could start imbibing them themselves and using them. And that for me, I didn't want my thoughts to just be kind of limited to academic journals and only discussed by fellow professors. And so she enabled me to kind of run a dual track where on the one hand, I was building up my academic credentials and became a professor, but at the same time was able to, you know, speak to people, real people, about the things that I really care about politics, about economics, about the kind of society we're living in, why it's like this, and about what we can do to change the state of the world to build back better.
Mm-hmm. No, I it's very interesting to me, the folks who you sort of did it from the very start, but there are other people. Deborah Tannen comes to mind, who start out with the first couple of books are very academic, stay with, and then they branch out and then they reach out. And I really think, I mean, what you've said makes all the sense in the world. If it's to impact society, it's gotta get in front of them. Here's a funny question. I asked you about your path the first time we spoke in 2001. How much about your path since then has surprised you?
Well, I mean, the success that I had with my first book, with The Silent Takeover, was unexpected. And you know, I was a young academic, and the first panel that I got asked to be part of, I was on a panel with Bill Clinton. Mm. So it was, Yeah, so it was kind of from 0 to 100 very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And really what that did was it gave me very quickly a voice on the public stage and a voice which I was able to use for the past 20 years. I've tried to use that for good as much as I can and just build upon it, really just keep evolving my own thinking as well. I've been really committed to doing that. And in many ways, this book, The Lonely Century, I see it as actually the follow-up to that book of 20 years ago, The Silent Takeover. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As I was writing this book, I kept on thinking, this is the follow-up to that book, even though I'd written other books in between. But it felt like that's what I was doing, and I was quite conscious of it. You know, it was again interrogating capitalism, mm-hmm. and asking these big questions about what kind of society have we created and what kind of society do we want and how do we get there instead.
And I'm going to phrase this question in a couple of ways. This is about this book. Was there a moment when you said, that's what I've got to focus on? This is the book I've got to write. And then, or even, what was the first itch that you scratched as you were beginning this one?
There were actually three that happened very close to each other, which made me think this is what I want to write about. The first was my students. Increasing numbers of them were coming into my office in office hours and confiding in me how lonely and isolated they felt. And this was a new phenomenon. I'd been teaching at university for over 20 years. And I hadn't witnessed so many students coming into my office and telling me that. Mm-hmm. And I also observed that when I set them group assignments, increasing numbers were struggling with face-to-face interaction. Something, again, that I hadn't seen before. So I thought, okay, there's something going on here. And then at pretty much the same time in my academic research, I was researching the rise of right-wing populism across the globe. So Trump voters in the US, but also in France, in Germany, in Italy. And as I was interviewing right-wing populist voters and hearing their testimonies, one thing kept on coming across from their stories, how lonely they felt. Lonely in the sense of feeling disconnected, socially isolated, bereft of friends, brotherhood, support networks, but also lonely in the sense of feeling disconnected from the state, from their politicians, left forsaken, invisible, unheard. So I was seeing loneliness amongst my students. Loneliness was the theme coming up time and time again from my research from the right-wing populist voters I was interviewing. And then I had bought an Alexa and I became very interested in the fact that I was feeling increasingly affectionate towards my Alexa and increasingly close to my Alexa, really. And and I thought, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And it made me start looking at what I've come to call the loneliness economy. Mm-hmm. So an entire economy of goods and products and services that are being designed to meet our craving for connection and even community. And it was those three kind of insights happening at roughly the same time, which made me think there's something going on here. Loneliness is a way of making sense of where we are at, of being able to define what we have created, the kind of society we've created, but also by framing contemporary life, but also by interrogating contemporary life through the lens of loneliness, I felt I might be able to make headway when it came to coming up with recommendations mm-hmm. for what we need to do moving forward.
Yeah, I'm struck by how, if you will, micro and macro those experiences are, right? On the one hand, yes. It's an individual student in an intimate moment sharing something personal. Then you go back to, now I'm looking at global populism, and the same thread is playing in both.
I think that's something that's common to all my work, in that my work has always been rooted on the ground, and I've always taken a very bottom-up approach to my thinking. So, you know, it was hearing the testimonies of the right-wing populist voters that made me start thinking about the loneliness they were feeling. It was seeing my students. It was my experience with my Alexa, and I've always built these bigger ideas about capitalism and the world and where we're in from the bottom up. And for me, that's the right way. That is the right way of doing it.
Now, one crucial thing, I think I referred to it in the introduction, is that you very much broaden the definition of loneliness. In other words, you point out very early that while some people might think loneliness is defined by being alone, by solitude, by isolation, you broaden the definition. And let me flesh this out even more. If what we're really talking about is connection or disconnection, why term it loneliness? And I thought about that at first, and I thought, well, maybe it's because this lack of connection will always lead to loneliness. But I don't think it even does, because I think many people are not necessarily alone, yet still disconnected and lonely. How did you wrestle with this? Because it's at the very core of what you're writing about and thinking about and talking about.
So the way I define loneliness is that it's not just about feeling that you're lacking and craving companionship and friendship and intimacy, although it is that too. But it is also about feeling disconnected from your friends, from your colleagues, from people in your neighborhood, but also disconnected from these bigger institutions, from your employer, from politicians, from the government, from the state. It's about feeling unseen, unheard, invisible, whether in your kind of immediate environment or relative to these bigger structures. And there have been, you know, I'm not the first thinker to think about loneliness as an existential state. Marx, of course, talked about alienation. Durkheim talked about anomie. Hannah Arendt, when she talked about loneliness, also talked about it in this kind of bigger sense. So I knew that I was building on a kind of tradition of thinking about loneliness in this broader way. But you're absolutely right that there is a distinction between being alone and being lonely. Like, the two are not the same necessarily at all. You know, you can be very lonely in a crowd of people, and you can be on your own and not feel lonely and feel connected to others, for sure.
Yeah. So let's spend a couple of minutes here talking about the pandemic, because obviously at this time, it's a crucial piece. And first question is, how do you feel how has the pandemic changed people's experience of loneliness, and how did it change your book?
So even before the pandemic struck, 1 in 5 Americans felt lonely often or always. 1 in 5 millennials didn't have a single friend at all. 40% of office workers felt lonely at work. So even before the pandemic, we were in the midst of a global loneliness crisis. The pandemic has significantly accelerated and amplified it. Recent data, US data, suggests that as much as 50% of the population currently feel lonely. So loneliness already was a really significant problem. But, you know, it makes sense that people are feeling lonelier after month upon month of social distancing and stay-at-home orders and self-isolation. Mm-hmm. And it also makes sense that people are feeling, that particular groups are feeling especially lonely, because that's an interesting fact. Even though loneliness can affect all of us, rich, poor, male, female, young, old, there are three groups who've become especially lonely during the pandemic. The young, who actually already were the loneliest generation, which is surprising perhaps to some, because we often think about the elderly being the loneliest. And even though, of course, there are cases of elderly loneliness in the United States, before the pandemic, 60% of nursing home people who lived in nursing homes had never received any visitors at all.
Let me cut in for 1 second. That statistic stopped me in my tracks.
Yes.
I just want to repeat two of the statistics you've mentioned. One in five young people, and that's young people 18s and 20s, or how did you, the one in five that say they have no friend at all.
Yes.
Okay, so that's phenomenal. One in five. See five young people in a park, one of them doesn't have a single friend. And that 60%, three out of five people in nursing homes receive no visitors ever. It's just, those two just, as I said, just stop me in my tracks.
It breaks your heart. In Japan, actually, with the elderly, there's such a crisis of loneliness amongst the elderly that the fastest growing demographic for people being incarcerated in Japan are retirees, people over the age of 70, because they're so lonely that many are intentionally committing minor crimes like shoplifting in order to be incarcerated so that they can find company and companionship. I know, it's terrible. Terrible. But it's actually the young who are the loneliest. Mm-hmm, and during the pandemic, the young have become especially lonely. People on low income have become especially lonely. Again, even though everyone can be lonely, we already knew before the pandemic that if you're on low income, if you're unemployed, you're more likely to be lonely. And this group have become lonelier during the pandemic, inevitably linked to a sense of feeling forsaken, a sense of feeling ignored, marginalized at this very difficult time, or a sense of being invisible and kind of needs not being met, amplified. You know, the pandemic has just amplified the fissures and fractures that already existed. But the other group who are disproportionately lonelier are women. And that took some more thought to unpack why that would be.
Yes. Yes, let me just say, my immediate response is, but they're the more social gender. They're the ones we've heard all along. It's about bonding. It's about belonging. It's social intercourse where men are happy with numbers and that sort of thing. What explains that?
So that's during the pandemic. And so I think it's a few things at play. Firstly, we're witnessing a she session. Women are bearing a disproportionate economic brunt of the current economic downturn. And so, and we know that unemployment, we know that losing your job, being on lower income is linked to loneliness. So that's part of the reason. Part of the reason is that sadly we're seeing a rise in domestic abuse during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's nothing lonelier than being in an abusive relationship, for sure. And part of it is that the informal support networks that women typically have in their lives, and you're right, I really dislike gender stereotypes. typing. I just want to be clear on this, but you are right that you know, women tend to have kind of deeper social networks than men. But a lot of these and a lot of these have had to be diminished because you know, whilst we've had to stay at home, for sure. And I think the other reason is that women have this growing sense of, many women have experienced a growing sense of powerlessness and lack of agency in the home during the pandemic, as they've had to take on disproportionate amounts of childcare and housework, as well as hold down jobs where they still have their jobs as well. And so I think it's for those reasons combined that we're seeing women disproportionately lonelier during this pandemic.
During the pandemic. Let me correct one thing I said earlier and then pick up your thought. Don't lose your thought. When I had asked in that 1 in 5 who report having no friends at all, it's actually millennials. I was thinking it was teenagers or no, millennials, which is a huge group. The largest generation since the boomer generation, 1 in 5 don't have a friend. I just wanted to correct that I'd made an error before. Elderly, young, economically disadvantaged, and women are being particularly hard hit by the pandemic.
Yes, although, you know, when 50% of Americans are saying that they currently feel lonely, we know that, you know, we're all in danger of being affected if we're not already, and we're all bound to know someone who's feeling lonely, even if we aren't ourselves.
And I would guess that that thing that people have been able to, even if it hasn't touched their own life, they've heard about it or thought about it on television, is the notion of more than ever, people are dying alone.
Yes, which is just heartbreaking.
One distinction that you make that I just want to touch on so that I don't miss it is difference, if you will, between solitude and isolation, the role of agency in loneliness.
That's a really important point to make clear. So, yes, being on your own, choosing to be on your own, what we might think call solitude, it can be a very rewarding experience. I'm somebody who actually likes spending time on my own. I like reading books or watching a show on my own. Writing, of course, is a very solitary profession. So, I like moments of solitude. And that is different to being lonely because you're choosing to be on your own and do things on your own. Loneliness is associated with a lack of agency. This isn't your choice. If you had a choice, you would want to feel connected. If you had a choice, you would want to have companionship. And it's feeling that you don't have a choice, that this is how you're having to live, but it's not how you wish to live.
Let me tell people right now that we're at about the halfway point. This is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Narina Hertz, economist, journalist, author most recently of The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. And that's the book we're talking about today. And you can learn more about all of her work at Narina.com, Noreena.com. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2021 conversation with Narina Hertz about her book, The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. You can learn more at Noreena.com, Noreena.com. One thing I want to, again, touch on before we move on is the consequences. People may, one of the things that you talk about, of course, in the book is surprising realities that don't mesh with people's stereotypical sort of thoughts about loneliness. And we've talked about some of that already. People think the elderly may be the most lonely. Turns out that's not true. People may think that loneliness is psychological, emotional, mental health issue. But as you point out, the costs in terms of physical health are enormous.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, there are also mental health implications, and loneliness is associated with higher rates of anxiety, depression, and even suicide, which is particularly concerning, given how these heightened levels of loneliness amongst us. And indeed, in Japan, we're seeing a real rise in suicide rates, especially amongst women during the pandemic, and loneliness clearly playing a part there. But loneliness is also really bad for our physical health. Basically, the reason why this is because we're not designed to be lonely. We're essentially hardwired to connect. We are essentially creatures of togetherness. And what happens, and so we've been designed so that when we are lonely, an alarm goes off in our body. Our blood pressure goes up, our cortisol levels, our stress hormones in our body go up, our cholesterol levels go up. We go into fight or flight mode, a state of high alert, basically telling us to go and find other people, find companionship, hunt and gather with others. And the trouble is that in contemporary life, we don't respond to that physical warning. Instead, we remain in this state of fight or flight for protracted periods, for days, for weeks, for months, even for years. And that is really bad for our health, in the same way that if you put a car in first gear, that's great for it to take off, but you don't want to keep driving with your car in first gear. Well, we don't want to keep our bodies in a constant state of loneliness. And the health ramifications are really serious. If you're lonely, you have a 29% higher chance of getting heart disease, a 32% higher risk of getting a stroke, a 64% higher chance of getting dementia. In fact, loneliness is as bad for our health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Yeah, there's another one of those statistics that I think will stick with people. Yeah, 15 cigarettes a day is what you're doing when you spend a day being lonely. So we can see the costs. One of the big thrusts of your book, I think, and we've talked about it a bit already, is that you connect the personal and the political. And you say loneliness is political as much as it is personal. Talk about that. I've got a number of questions, but let me just throw that broadly to you.
So there are a number of drivers for why this is the lonely century. Technology, our smartphones, and we might want to talk about
that. Oh, we will.
Okay. You know, the way we've built our cities, the fact that we do less with other people than in the past. We go to church less. We're less likely to be members of trade unions. We are less likely to go to parent-teacher associations. So a whole host of drivers. But also, and something that I single out in my book, a key driver is a political driver, and that is the particular kind of capitalism that has dominated for the last 40 years. The dog-eat-dog, greed-is-good kind of capitalism, known as neoliberalism, not to be confused with kind of the American liberal concept, which is a progressive concept, but neoliberalism, which essentially has really valorized over the past few decades self-interest, hyper-competitiveness, and undervalued traits like caring for each other, compassion, and of course community. And we see this ideology impact loneliness in a number of ways. Firstly, of course, because what we've witnessed over the past 40 years has been a growing asymmetry in terms of income and wealth. between those on low income and those who are earning a lot of money. And meaning that lots of people legitimately do feel forsaken, left behind, forgotten, because in economic terms, at least in relative terms, they have been.
Exactly.
So the other reason why this form of capitalism has played such a fundamental role in today's loneliness crisis is because of the what we might think of as the neoliberal mindset that has also taken hold over the past few decades, where people came to see themselves as competitors rather than collaborators, as hustlers rather than helpers, as takers rather than givers. And where they were rewarded for seeing themselves in such a way. And in many ways, it was the rational response to a world in which the state had absconded its responsibility for looking after you if life was tough and if you were on your knees. You know, if I am not for I, who will be? And of course, a me-focused, selfish world was inevitably, self-interested mindset was inevitably going to beget a lonely world. So that's another part of the reason. And then there's a very practical part of the reason as well, which is political in some sense too, which is that the infrastructure of community, public parks, public libraries, playgrounds, youth clubs, elderly daycare centres, community centres have been starved funding for many decades now, but especially since 2008 and the financial crisis, when we've really seen governments and states at local and national levels really withdraw funding from these public spaces. In the United States, federal funding of public libraries fell by 40%. From 2008. And these are not only places where we come together, they're also places where we learn how to be together.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you make the point that when these spaces disappear, let's go pre and post pandemic, when we are not gathering, when we are not meeting in the community, we're losing perhaps some skills and even some sensibility that is essential to successful democracy.
Yes, because that it's in these public spaces where we practice inclusive democracy, where we practice being civil to other people, where we practice being mindful of other people's needs, where we practice being with people who are not like us. It's in these public spaces. They're absolutely fundamental to any notion of an inclusive democracy. And yet we've allowed them to be diminished over the past few decades at our collective peril.
Yeah. No, I can just see. I very often think about how it's, you know, there's lists of priorities. And the self-interested lobbyists and corporate, and wealthy, they have their list of priorities. And then there's the regular people, and you know, their priorities are going to be healthcare, jobs, education, something like libraries, something like public spaces, just doesn't jump to the top, you know, for either of those lists. And so without really making a choice, it's almost an abdication of choice, we let them shrink. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was reminded of, I don't know if you know the work of Mary O'Hara, who wrote a book called The Shame Game, which is about the narrative, because I think narratives play a big role in what we're talking about here, that it's your fault if you're poor. Basically pick yourself up by your bootstraps, things that come out of the Reagan and Thatcher worldview that have made that have compounded the pain and the lack of agency of people at the bottom of the economic order.
Absolutely. And, you know, and also created a sense of loss of status, mm-hmm. that, you know, that is heartfelt, especially in perhaps amongst white working class men who, you know, historically didn't feel that way.
Right.
And have come to feel that, as, you know, as some of the Trump voters told me, you know, we used to have good jobs here, mm-hmm. but now they're all like low paid. It's not just the pay, they're all low paid, low status jobs. You know, we used to have pride in our work. We used to have a brotherhood in our trade union, amongst our trade union, and we don't have that now.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and again, these things that get lost, sort of, you know, while our focus is on something else. But as I pointed out, you know, in my introduction, it's a slow, a gradual erosion that mm-hmm. is never the headline. It's not today's big news, but as your book and our conversation points out, the costs are enormous. Before we switch to talking about the role of social media and smartphones, etc., you point out that coming out of the Depression and World War II, the U.S. found a way to unite both politics and compassion. Europe, coming out of World War II, U.S. with the Marshall Plan. There was now people, you know, who grew up on Thatcher and Reagan may say, oh, that's not the job of government. That's idealistic. That's naive. But it wasn't.
Absolutely. And, you know, these two huge historical moments of collective crisis, the Great Depression and World War II, out of these terrible crises did come in the United States with the New Deal under Roosevelt, and in the UK with the founding of the National Health Service, Free Healthcare for All, came these kind of amazing initiatives which were around bringing people together, helping people, enhancing ordinary folks' rights. The New Deal, of course, had a whole program of worker rights coming off the back of the Great Depression, you know, a time when you might have thought, some people might have said, this isn't the time to give worker rights. You could imagine, mm-hmm. you know, a lobby saying that.
Oh, yeah.
But actually, you know, having the political conviction that this is the right time to do this. So out of moments of crisis, we have had these big progressive surges. And that's the hope, of course, and that's the choice we now need to make. You know, is this going to be one of those moments where we do build back better, where we do use our collective pain and grieving and hardship to think about how we can create something which is better for the collective, for our bigger community?
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, we just did not do enough in that regard coming out of the 2008-2009 crash. And like you, my hope is that the shared vulnerability of a pandemic, the shared vulnerability that it can affect. Yeah, there's disproportionate. We know that there's not equity in the treatment. There's not equity yet in the vaccines, for the most part. But that still, it's made us all realize that we, at least in regard to the epidemic, if not our solutions, we are in this together.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think it's also heightened two other things. I think we are acknowledging as a society the importance of people who care for others in a way that I think we just haven't done enough. in recent times. I mean, it's it's actually really interesting to see. In the UK, there was data that came out, saw a real spike in numbers of people who want now to be nurses, who want to be doctors. So qualities that the market and that neoliberal capitalism, you know, really undervalued, care, compassion, now kind of, you know, us recognizing actually as being important, which is about time. And the other reason why maybe this time's different is because I think many of us have many of us are recognizing the value of our local communities in a way that perhaps we didn't before, we didn't always before. And, you know, and I went on a journey even writing this book in this regard because, you know, Terence, I was somebody who was, you know, always flying around the world and, you know, in different cities the whole time. And I didn't feel particularly rooted in my own local.
You were as at home with a certain group of people anywhere as you were at home.
Yes, and I was proud to think of myself as a global citizen. I mean, I still do, but I recognize now the importance also of feeling rooted somewhere, of having a community where you do know your neighbors' names, when you do know your postman's name. My postman is Alan. And where you do stop and speak to people and where you do look out for each other. We don't have any outdoor space where we live. And during the pandemic, my neighbours did something, you know, incredibly kind and nice. They gave us the door keys to their house and they said, you know, whenever you want to use our garden, you can use our garden. I mean, which was, that's quite amazing. And I think many of us appreciate our local community more than we ever did. And I think that's different too. Really different.
Yeah, well, I'm very lucky in the area of Long Beach, California, that I live. I'm about a block from a commercial street with lots of cafes and shops and so on. Well, during the pandemic, we just see one after another, you know, going out of business. The national chains, some of them are going out of business, but the pain feels so much worse when it's the jewelry store that's been there for two generations or the little cafe that's a family's, you know, livelihood.
But that's why it's so essential that one of the things that we need to be doing as much as we can right now is to be supporting our local stores, our local cafes, our local bookshops. You know, these places anchor our communities. They nurture our communities. Even those small micro exchanges that we have in a bookshop, in our local grocery store, in our local cafe, you know, where we chat to the server or ask for a book recommendation, they really matter. They make us feel more connected to each other. They make us feel less lonely. They make us feel happier too. And so it is the devastation of Main Street that we're witnessing is, you know, has huge ramifications beyond the economic ones but societal ones and government, the state, local government, but us as well, need to do what we can to help these local businesses get back on their feet. It's essential.
Oh, it is. It is. It is to, you know, I mean, I just noted a note that I'd made, which you've made as well, which is that human beings survived and thrived as a species due to our abilities as social animals. We're not the fastest. We're not the strongest. And so we must, you know, and we pretend we tell ourselves perhaps that we needn't, but we must. Let's talk about the role of social media with all of society, and particularly with youth?
So I began my research really agnostic on the role that social media played in today's loneliness crisis. But after a few years really digging into the research and also interviewing many young people, in particular teenagers, on this subject, I came away really convinced that it's a very significant part of the problem. Partly because, as we all know, these media are built to create divisive, fractured discourse, polarized discourse, and in which people are shouting at each other in a particularly toxic way. It's good for their business, but it's bad for society. And it definitely makes you feel lonelier if you witness this kind of angry mob as you scroll on your phones. But also making people feel lonely because the relationships, the conversations that one has on social media are the kind of fast food equivalent, really, of conversations. Mm-hmm. And so you eat them, you gorge on them, but you don't really feel sated. And, they're just not, they're not like a real conversation, are they? An in-depth conversation. So that's part of the reason. And part of the reason is, of course, because they're so addictive, social media, designed, of course, to be addictive, that they take us away from our deeper connections with others, from being present, even with those around us, even with those around us in a room. I mean, I don't know, I've been guilty of it for sure. Terence, sitting on the sofa with my husband and both of us looking at our phones and not even really hearing each other. Mm-hmm. So bad for those reasons, but also because for the young especially, they are often vectors of exclusion. Mm-hmm. And that's something that really came out in my research that I had been less aware of. Because so much of teenagers' social lives has migrated to their phones, even before the pandemic, what is happening is that when they are excluded, so either excluded in a real world setting and their exclusion is then witnessed by their peers on their phones. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a 16-year-old girl told me about how her friends had said they weren't going to go out after school, but they did go out. She witnessed it on her social media feeds, them having fun without her, and she felt that her exclusion was so visible. She hid in her room for a week. She wouldn't go out. But also excluding because even on something like a WhatsApp group, I've had several teenagers talk to me about how it felt when they weren't invited to be part of a group. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were always cases of teenagers being excluded in the past. But what's happening is that the exclusion is very public.
It's broadcast. It's
broadcast to their peers. And yet the adults in their lives may well not be aware of it. So the teacher won't see a child not being asked to sit with others. The parent won't see that their child isn't being asked to join something. And can't intervene. So it's that's going on.
Mm-hmm. What is more obvious to their peers is less obvious to their parents.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's with the young that I'm particularly concerned about how cruel and toxic and hateful and addictive these media are. I mean, hateful as well. 65% of British students have experienced cyberbullying firsthand. And so I would go as far as to say that I think governments should ban addictive social media when it comes to children. And put the onus then on social media companies to come up with products which are not so addictive. Because in many ways, social media companies are the tobacco companies of the 21st century and should be regulated as such.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Harmful, And at this point, in terms of those things, unregulated. Yeah, I mean that as we said, it's deep in us as a species to be social, and yet they are playing with algorithms that trigger neurotransmitters that shift our pursuit of happiness. Right? In other words, what we pursue is dopamine, yes. Not connection.
Yeah,
and
I know.
And I mean the depth of that and the unknown of what comes from that is frightening.
Yeah, well, there was actually research done by Stanford University where they had 1,500 students were charged with using Facebook as usual. The other 1,500 were told to stop using Facebook for 2 months, and then they tracked what happened. Well, the group who stopped using Facebook, they didn't just go and spend more time on the internet. No, they actually did more in person with friends and family. But importantly, they felt significantly happier and significantly less lonely. So we know empirically.
That's right.
That
this is not anecdotal. This is not just making up a story. Finally, let me ask you this. If you could stand in, and I'll give you like a minute and a half or two. I'm sorry, but that's what we've got left. Stand in the future 5-10 years and we turn some of this around. How did we do it?
We did it because governments actually put loneliness and alleviating loneliness and reconnecting society at the heart of their programs. We did it because businesses realized that loneliness actually is bad for business. Lonely workers are less productive, less efficient, so they took loneliness seriously. And we did it because we made changes ourselves. We put our phones down and were more present with each other. We nurtured our local stores and our local cafes in order to protect our local communities. And we reached out to those amongst us who were feeling lonely and made sure that they felt visible, seen, and heard.
Very good. And those solutions are in Nerina Hertz's latest book, The Lonely Century. She talks about the evidence of how we are lonely and what it's doing to us. She talks about the history of how we got here, and then she offers solutions for how we can emerge from this less lonely, more connected, more human, ultimately. So again, the new book is The Lonely Century, How to Restore Human Connection in a World That's Pulling Apart. The website is Nerina.com, Nerena.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement, tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site, and they're searchable by guest or by issue. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, you name it. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Nerina Hertz. Good to talk to you again, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence, for having me on.